Psychedelic drugs, or at least stories of their use, were a large part of the fabric of the counterculture in the 1960s. Some people still insist that the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was a reference to LSD. LSD is but one of many illegal substances with the power to make us hallucinate and, some people say, expand our minds. They are generally illegal, but there are those people who insist that the spiritual and medicinal side of psychedelic drugs outweighs the risks of abusing them. Our guests today are in that camp. They're organizers of an upcoming event at Southern Oregon University called Exploring Psychedelics. Matt Vogel works at Southern Oregon University as a health promotion specialist and an adjunct instructor for the Department of Psychology. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Martin Ball is here as well. He is an adjunct professor of religious studies at Southern Oregon University. Martin, good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
So give us a sense of how far back the research goes. Can we call it research, and how can you do it at a time when the drugs themselves are illegal?
I could take that one. You know, there was a lot of research actually going on in the 1950s, 1960s, and then there was sort of a lot of public hysteria that really stopped a lot of the research from continuing. There were some studies done in the 1990s with a man named Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, but a lot of the reemergence of research has just kind of started again in about the past 10 years. One thing I actually have in front of me, there's a new psychedelic science group just recently formed at Yale. And it's sort of interesting. This is called the Yale Psychiatry and Psychedelics Group. It's organized by graduate students, mental health practitioners, faculty members to learn about alternative medicines such as psychedelic substances. And they're looking at creating a space for current research to be explored for things such as addiction, depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And you asked about how can this happen. Most of these compounds are considered by the federal government to be Schedule 1, but the FDA...
Schedule 1 meaning the drugs that are deemed as having no medicinal effect and therefore just pretty much outlawed for research and everything else?
Yes, they're considered to have no medicinal value according to the federal government. That said, though, the federal government is allowing a lot of research to be currently done with a lot of these compounds. So they're giving certain labs Schedule 1 status where they can create and synthesize some of the molecules, and they're also allowing studies to take place at places like UCLA Medical School, Johns Hopkins Medical School, Harvard, New York University, like really prominent places, again, where they're with FDA approval and DEA oversight, they're allowing these things to be studied again, and the results have been actually really positive. So I think we're in an interesting time where there's a more opening up, I think, of looking at these things from a more logical kind of perspective than a hysterical perspective.
You went through a fairly quick list there, but there were some particularly promising effects that were noticed, I think, for LSD and at least some of the companion substances at the time of the declaration of them as an illegal substance. Mm-hmm. What was the number one beneficial effect that was deemed to be happening?
There was numerous ones, but one that was interesting was around alcoholism and addiction with LSD. Bill Wilson was one of the founders of AA, and he
Bill W. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He felt that he didn't quite quit his relationship with alcohol until he actually had a LSD-assisted psychotherapy session where he could actually sort of look at what was underneath his addiction. And he actually encouraged that to be written into the bylaws of AA, that could be used as a part of the therapeutic process, which did not occur. But there was a lot of studies going on looking at addiction, particularly at the time.
Yeah, prior to kind of the hysteria of the war on drugs, particularly in Europe, studies into psychedelics was really centered on therapeutic approaches, psychoanalytic approaches. It was something that was kind of appreciated by European intelligentsia in the sense of a lot of writers, philosophers, artists, psychotherapists were really curious about these substances and their potential to help people transform their relationships to themselves and their own traumas and their own psychological issues. And really a lot of that got squashed through the hysteria of the war on drugs. And kind of what we're going through right now, both culturally and academically, is what's kind of being called the psychedelic renaissance right now, where a lot more universities and research institutions are starting to look at these things again. And mostly they're coming to an agreement that a Schedule 1 a listing for these substances really is not accurate because there are a great deal of medicinal uses. And Schedule 1 is also something that lists substances as being prone to abuse and addiction. And that really doesn't fit with many of these substances that we're talking about, that they don't have addictive properties and that they're also not prone to abusive situations because they do tend to be rather challenging for people. And it's, you know, something that becomes therapeutic, but that's not necessarily something that you're going to abuse, quote, every day, and it's going to lead you down the wrong path in life, that it actually tends to be beneficial for people when used in the proper setting.
All right. So let's talk about that, because I realize I'm leaving a lot of people out. People who didn't live through the 1960s might not appreciate the sense of psychedelics. So what do they do on an individual, but what happens when you take them, and what are the reasons people would take them in the first place, assuming they're not taking from medicinal reasons because they're not out there as medicine right now?
Well, one of the fascinating aspects about psychedelics is that there are a large variety of them, and they do have different ranges of effects that they produce within people. So different psychedelic compounds might be used for different reasons. So it's kind of hard to lump them all together. But at a very general level, that certainly it allows people to encounter aspects of themselves that maybe they're not consciously aware of. So emotional, psychological patterns. You know, many people make this statement that, you know, a one trip on ayahuasca is worth 10 years of psychotherapy. And it sounds kind of cliche, but that really is the experience that a lot of people have when working with these kinds of substances, where they're presented with content in a way that is very viscerally immediate to them, and it allows them to process through their emotions and their thought patterns in a way that they can encounter themselves and encounter these issues within themselves, then also transform their relationship to that in a way that is much more immediate than, say, doing talk therapy with a therapist, where it might take you years and years and years to uncover the core emotional trauma that you're encountering that is creating all of these emotional and social difficulties within your life. But within a session with one of these medicines, you can encounter that and transform it all within the course of a night. So that becomes very, very powerful and empowering for people, especially for people who are dealing with life-crippling addiction or depression or other psychological issues, that people feel that they're reborn, in a sense, that they're able to emerge from these experiences with a renewed interest in life and themselves and living honestly with themselves and living authentically with themselves and with others. So it's very powerful for people.
Martin Ball and Matt Vogel are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. They are the organizers of the Exploring Psychedelics event coming April 7th and 8th to the Southern Oregon University Stevenson Union Rogue River Room. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Comments, questions, experiences, welcome at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Gene in Winston. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hello. Oh, I really appreciate this program. It makes me... stimulates my interest in exploring psychedelics again. I'm 83 years old now, and it's been over four decades since I had a little bit of experience with psychedelics, but I'm afraid I didn't have any, like, therapeutic use. I was so intrigued with the sensory effects. Like, when I was on an LSD trip, I could hear the candle singing, and I could see every leaf on a tree sort of quivering. I mean, it was just a tremendous kind of sensory experience, and now I wish I had tried to look in my inner self more. Maybe I'll have an opportunity to do that sometime, but I think people ought to be able to ingest whatever they want to, and if it kills them, that's their responsibility. And so another thing, I think if you take LSD, for instance, I think it's safer if you have somebody with you so you don't think you can fly off the top of a building. That's just my personal idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gene. Very much appreciate sharing the story with us.
Near the end of what Gene said there about having someone with you, I think that goes back to even kind of what Martin was talking about, too, the context in which people are using these things, right? So if someone is doing something like, hey, I've had six beers and I'm really partying and I'm going to shroom or something like that, right? There's a certain context to that versus sort of this other context that's more intentional or therapeutic, right? So doing this, how it's sort of the set and the setting is a huge kind of component to that. And I think that was sort of maybe what she was getting at near the end with having support around it.
Yeah. And something that I'd like to pick up on with what she said there is that the therapeutic use and kind of the intentional inner investigation into the nature of yourself and your own issues, that's one aspect of what psychedelics make available in a very palpable way. But one of the concerns with this sort of resurging interest in psychedelics and the psychedelic renaissance is that some people, and I would include myself in this, are concerned that maybe we're pigeonholing it into therapy a little bit too much. You know, that there is a concern that, well, as the legal situation changes, that maybe you'll be able to go to a therapist and do this kind of work. But I'm also an advocate of the idea that you have a right to do what you want with your own body and with your own mind, and that the therapeutic approach to psychedelics is only one of many different areas in which it can be applicable, you know, for artists, musicians, or people who just want to go out and enjoy nature. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. It doesn't need to be therapeutic, but we can understand that there are different modalities, there are different contexts, I don't think that we should just limit it to the therapeutic, but I think that that's a very important aspect, and probably that's the one that's going to help change some of the legal status around these substances first. And then maybe we can talk more about just the personal use. But I think that there's a wide variety of reasons that people enjoy experiencing psychedelics because they're novel and they're fascinating. And yeah, you can get to hear candles sing. And that's actually quite interesting for people.
And you come to this yourself. Have you done this through religious ceremonies? I mean, you do teach religious studies. I have to wonder if you've done Native American ceremonies with ayahuasca or anything else.
Yes, I've actually participated in ayahuasca, Santo Daime, the Native American church. So I've experienced this both within a ceremonial context and outside of a ceremonial context. And there are differences. And, you know, it has been part of my studies as a religious studies professor. And then I would also admit to outside of that as well, because I find them fascinating.
Let's take another call. Here's Jesse in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking psychedelic drugs with Martin Ball and Matt Vogel.
Jesse. Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Great. Thank you. No, I just wanted to pipe in that I really kind of connect with what they're saying. I experimented with psychedelics, you know, widely as a youthful man and was experiencing the sensory overload, and I didn't get much from it. But then one time I was in South America and I found a shaman out in the jungle and took ayahuasca, and it was a completely different experience with the set and setting. Like, it was a kind of earth-shattering religious experience. I ended, you know, 10 years of terrible clinical depression and alcohol dependency in literally 8 hours. And it changed my life.
Wow.
And I wouldn't have never thought that was possible without the shaman guiding me through this experience. And he spoke in Quechua the whole time, but I knew what he was telling me. It was completely life-altering.
Okay, it's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing that, Jesse. Appreciate that. So let's talk about, I imagine you have to tread lightly given what's going on with legality or lack thereof of psychedelic drugs. I mean, you're advocating recreational use, you're advocating limited therapeutic use, therapeutic and religious, therapeutic, religious, and limited recreational. I mean, how broadly do you go here, Matt Vogel?
I think advocating is a tricky word. I don't know if there's
advocating. Like I said, tread lightly. Yes.
Right. I think that what's interesting, I would just say largely, is that I would say as a society, there's more openness to talking about this now. This is something that I think people were nervous to talk about for many, many years. It was sort of this underground thing, but now it's kind of like, hey, this is, as people continue to critique, I mean, major public health institutions all over the world are critiquing our global drug policies and seeing the harms that these are actually causing, more harm, you know, the sort of unintended consequences of our policies. As we see, while that's happening, there's also these other areas bubbling up where people are saying, hey, let's have a more broad, holistic conversation about compounds in general. So that's going to include that. It's going to include critiques of our drug policies, but it's also going to include, hey, what are sort of uses for these things? What if these, you know, we have no problem. Right now in the United States, we have 5% of the world's population. It's estimated we take about 50% of the global pharmaceutical drug supply. So of all drugs made on planet Earth, 50% are consumed here. The UN actually estimates it's higher.
And we're 5% of the world population.
And we're 5% of the world's population. So we have no problem with humans taking molecules. We actually encourage it on TV. Two countries in the world allowed direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical drugs. So it's like we know that is occurring. So now we're saying, well, these are also molecules. Let's talk about ways in which maybe there's aspects of these that we can have a more rich discussion about it without fear, because we have to. This is a rational kind of place to go, I think, in our society.
How careful do you guys have to be as employees of Southern Oregon University? I mean, obviously they let you hold the conference on campus, but I'm just curious as to know how close the supervision is about what you say or I'm carefully using the word advocate again about psychedelics.
We don't honestly know. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is an event that we decided to put on, and we're hosting it here at SOU, and we're doing that because we are employees of SOU, and so that gives us access to the conference room. But no one from the university has ever spoken with me in any capacity, and as an adjunct professor, you know, I don't know if the listeners are really aware that, you know, there's these different rankings of professors, and adjunct professors, we're kind of at the bottom in the sense that we teach one class a term, and that's really, that's the extent of our involvement with the university. So I come in and I teach my class 2 days a week, and other than that, I don't have a lot to do with SOU, so I don't really know if SOU likes that we put this on or not. Matt probably has a better idea.
Well, I think that there's an openness to academic exploration on all campuses. And what I tell people is, like, we're just talking about it. There's no advocacy one way or the other, to be honest with you. We're just talking about it. And on other universities, they're giving people compounds. They're running clinical trials at UW-Madison, at, like I said, Johns Hopkins, UCLA. And they're giving people these things. So it's like, I think there's a...
We're just
conceptually, academically kind of exploring the discussion around it, whereas other places are running, like I said, running clinical trials. So I think we're very much in the confines of academic exploration for sure.
Yeah. And I would also point out that just in terms of the local environment or the local context here, that there's a variety of legal psychedelic churches that are right here in Ashland. And so these are legal battles that these religious organizations have brought to the courts, and they've had their rights recognized. And this is something that is precedent setting that's happened right here in Ashland. So I think it's a great environment to address these questions in an academic context.
Okay, exploring psychedelics. Next week, April 7th and 8th at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. Martin Ball and Matt Vogel are the organizers. Thank you both for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care.